Everyone who has been a guest on this podcast is someone I'm either friends with and or admire and respect. I've kept this standard for all 140 episodes so far. Occasionally, there's the marquee guest whose appeal stretches out and brings this podcast welcomed exposure, like Duff McKagan, Henry Rollins. Most are respected musicians, comedians who have a reputable CV and cred that stretches for days. Often I'm nervous before a podcast begins. The guest is someone who I'm excited to have on and curious to find out where our discussion will take us. But I don't think I have ever been as nervous as I was on this next episode. This is my talk with Mal Sharp, the famed man on the street and one half of the legendary comedic prank duo Coyle and Sharp. To me, in my world, on my personal list of luminaries, Mal Sharp ranks very, very, very high. Here is a man who helped pioneer the public prank or put on. Andy Kaufman, David Letterman, Howard Stern, Jackass, Sacha Baron Cohen, Nardwar the Human Serviette, MTV's Punk'd, they all took and were inspired by, whether they realize it or not, Coyle and Sharp. For listeners who are unfamiliar with the duo, I'll explain here, and I'm also going to do something I've never really done before, which is play bits of the guest's work during the podcast. This is on Mal's request, and it makes perfect sense to me. This puts the discussion I had with Mal into context, and we'll be able to hold everyone's attention. Because believe me, Coyle and Sharp were so funny. I guarantee you, if you just hang on to the bits, you will be busting a gut, laughing your ass off. So Coyle and Sharp were a comedy duo that took to the streets and posed insane, surreal, fantastical situations, questions, and theories to random everyday people of San Francisco between 1961 and 1965. They recorded all these conversations and managed to put out two albums out on Warner Brothers, The Absurd Imposters in 1963 and The Insane But Hilarious Minds of Coyle and Sharp in 1964. They moved to Los Angeles in 1965 to film a pilot TV show for ABC, but the pilot was never picked up, and the duo broke up shortly after. In the time since their legend has grown and their fans, although few, are rabid, and I count myself as one of them. In the mid to late 90s, Mal Sharp released two new Coyle and Sharp compilations of recordings. On the Loose on Henry Rollins' 213-61 record label in 1995, and Audio Visionaries, Street Pranks and Put-Ons on the Thirsty Ear record label in 1999. These were more impromptu discussions out on the street with random people culled from over 100 hours of recordings, and a new generation got exposed to Coyle and Sharp. My history with Coyle and Sharp, in the most appropriate way, works backwards. I discovered Mal Sharp first on Dick Clark and Ed McMahon's TV's Bloopers and Practical Jokes, and then found his second album on Rhino, The Man on the Street, out of all places, The Record Peddler in Toronto. I then found his first record, The Meaning of Life. And then, when Rollins put out On the Loose, the world of Coyle and Sharp opened up to me. To give you an idea of the material, the duo would approach strangers and ask them if they could drill holes in their heads and perform brain surgery that would turn their heads into ashtrays, piggy banks, cameras. They'd pretend they were werewolves. They would pretend to rent children out, propose crazy schemes like threeism and polylingua, vocal projection, and Sandor 21. It was fucking insane, and it was brilliant. There are a lot of funny people out there today, but I don't really see too many people doing bits like the Coyle and Sharp edges bit, or their eating people at a death ritual bit. And to think they did this between 1961 and 1965, it is fucking mind-blowing. It's genius. Jim Coyle passed away in 1992, but Mal Sharp is still living here in San Francisco playing jazz in his Big Money and Jazz outfit. He released a Coyle and Sharp box set in 2006 on his Sharp World label, and between 2007 and 2010, there was a Coyle and Sharp podcast that called from released and unreleased bits that went on for 100 episodes and can still be downloaded and listened to on iTunes. Listen to this, please. This is me talking to a legend. Rarely do I get this close to real historic legends on the podcast, but I did it on this episode. Like I mentioned at the top, I was real nervous to talk to Mal. Our conversation even started rough when I swear I thought I wasn't recording. Anyways, we both got back on the saddle, and I just can't believe I got to talk to Mal Sharp. Please look past how fanboyish I got with him, but really, there will never be another Coyland Sharp. And when you realize this, you can't help but be in awe when you talk to Mal. And since we've uploaded this episode on Christmas Eve, I offer this episode as my Christmas gift to all of you for hanging around and listening to the podcast all this throughout the whole year and for the last 5.5 years. Thanks a lot. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. I will see you in the new year with more episodes. I can't wait. It's going to be a lot of fun. Like always, this podcast is supported by Blue Mic Microphones and Skullcandy Headphones. Please leave a rating and or a review on iTunes because it really does help the podcast's profile. It works because we were recently featured on iTunes in their What's Hot section. Anyways, okay. Mal Sharp is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. Merry Christmas.
Podcasts are my life. I listen all the time. If I had to choose, I'd choose one all the time. This one is so grand. I know you'd understand. Oh, what fun it is to hear the best one in the land. Danko Jones, Danko Jones, Danko Jones podcast. Listen to it all year round. I know you'll have a blast. Hey, Danko Jones, Danko Jones, Danko Jones podcast. Listen to it all year round. I know you'll have a blast.
Thank you for listening to the Danko Jones podcast. Motherfuckers! It's fucking great! It fucking slays! Thank you for listening to the Danko Jones podcast! You motherfuckers!
I got to know Danko a few years ago when I used my vacation time to follow the band on the road. And I even spent a day with Danko in some European town that escapes me. But we ended up talking about 17th century art, his pet rock collection, the summers he spent as a teenage air traffic controller, his venomous snake collection, his passion for planking, and the night he spent with Ringo Starr's housekeeper. He's a fascinating character with a wealth of stories to share. And I'm a huge fan of Danko, but a bigger fan of his stories.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready because the Danko Jones podcast starts. No!
I just want to say I'm a little nervous talking to you because I'm a huge fan. I get to figure that out from my emails and
right. Don't worry about it, Danko.
Okay.
Be nervous about talking to me. It's the last thing you have to do.
I've heard your voice in the most fantastical ways for years, so it's a bit surreal. But the way I found out about you, I just wanted to tell you, is backwards, and I guess in a perfect Coyland Sharp way. I discovered you on TV Bloopers and Practical Jokes.
When
you're doing the Dick Clark and Ed McMahon show as the man on the street. And then I found your 1984 album in a record store, and I bought that. And then I found Meaning of Life. And then in the earlier mid-90s, Henry Rollins put out the Coyland Sharp CD, On the Loose. And then I was
back a long ways.
Yeah, and then I was looking at the photo, and I'm like, that looks like the guy, the man on the street. And so I worked my way completely backwards to discover just who you were and Corlin Sharp and everything. And now, of course, I've worked my way forwards. And it wasn't until that On the Loose CD that I kind of patched everything together. And then when I heard On the Loose, I couldn't believe that this was done in the early 60s. So my question, I guess, I have a million of them, and I know you guys, I know we don't have a million years to talk about it, but how did you guys patch this idea of going out into the streets? And I understand in the early 60s, it was just a different world, a more trusting world, but how did this all come about?
Well, I met Jim Coyle in this sort of boarding house in San Francisco, and he liked to put people on. I mean, he was a pretty strange guy. And I don't know, one night he was sitting at the table with these three girls, and he was telling them, I didn't even know him, you know, I was just sitting there, that he somehow was in some experiment where he would go out to the headlands in San Francisco and lie on rocks, and they would transmute his age or something, and that actually he was a Spanish Civil War veteran, but he looked much younger now since he'd been in this project. And the girls were just agape at the whole thing, you know what I mean? And I was like, who is this guy? You know? And so I walked up. He had a room actually near me. And I went inside, and it was filled with, you know, LPs, Bruckner and Mahler and all this other stuff. And I said, what are you doing down there? And he just started laughing and told me he just likes to put people on. So that's the expression we use then. Is that an expression we use now, put people on?
Yeah.
I'm punk,
punk, I would say, is the more modern version.
Yeah, the more modern version.
Put on, I prefer put on.
Yeah. So I started hanging out with him, and, you know, he would dress up as a priest. He was very Irish looking, and we'd get into movies free. I'd be his, like, attendant or something like that. And I don't know, we just started walking around, and he couldn't help himself. No matter what he did, he would get involved in something. So we decided... we both moved to New York for different reasons, but we decided in New York, after hanging around McDougal Street, and we used to call it then terrorizing tourists, but that's a bad term, too.
It's
changed, you know. Anyway, you know, we try and sell them toasters and things like that on the street. It's just bad, you know. We decided to go back to San Francisco and see if we somehow could make some kind of living doing this. So we went back to San Francisco and got a miniature tape recorder, and went out with it in a little leather briefcase and started punking people. What is that? Whatever word you want to use.
Right.
Yeah, putting people on. And that's how it all started. We had no idea what we were really going to do with any of this stuff. We just started collecting it.
So, I mean, it was Coyle who brought you into the world, his world of the con, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. I don't even know what attracted me to it. But at the beginning, because I had gone to Boston University School of Communications, I know how to turn a tape recorder on and off.
Right.
Not a digital recorder, a tape recorder. So I really just went with them, held the briefcase, and turned the thing off, on and off, and slowly started to kind of get engaged with him as his partner in these endeavors. And so that's, you know, one thing led to another, and here we are.
Do you think that new techniques in the film are making Hollywood films better?
Yes, I do, actually.
Do you feel that a new technique of vocal projection could conceivably meet with an open mind on the part of the public?
Well, with view to myself, I'm in favor of any new techniques, see how they do, and then judge them after they come out.
Can we give you an example of it now, just to get your reaction to it?
If it's quick.
Okay, fine.
We'll be very quick. Here we go. This is a scene. I'm a detective. This gentleman is some type of criminal who has a weapon. You got that gun? Give me the gun. Gun.
You can have the gun. I won't give you the gun.
Give me the gun. Gun. I want that gun. I want that gun. I want that gun. Give it to me. Give it now. It's my gun.
No.
Give me. I want that gun. Gun. Give me the gun.
Could you try now with ourselves to speak in this manner, and then we'd like to ask your opinion?
Very much doubt it.
Let me just show you that you can. Simply ask us the time. Simply say, would you give me the time? Just quickly.
The problem with giving you the time is, I mean, there's no deep emotions involved.
Do you want to take something more emotional? I mean, would you like to take part in the detective scene again, where you would say, stay away from the gun, stay away from the gun. Would you feel that more intensely?
You could do it under that circumstance. Yeah. Saying the time. I mean, I'm just saying that there would have very little real meaning to it there.
All right, let's do it this time. You're an associate of Mr. Coyle here, but you're telling him to stay away from the gun, and I have the gun, right?
Yeah.
Okay, your role is stay away from that gun. Stay away. Don't get near the gun. Okay.
Okay.
Right. Give me the gun.
You can't have the gun.
Thank you.
They stand up today and they can like make anyone laugh. Whereas if you hear some comedy that's maybe a decade old or two decades old, it just doesn't stand up. These bits were just so cerebral and it just came from left field and they were well thought out. What is the process of these bits between the two of you? How did you guys come up with some of these crazy ideas?
This is a very valuable lesson to me. We would get together every day before we went out on the street. We'd meet in a coffee shop in San Francisco's North Beach, maybe. And we had a big manila envelope that had the releases in it. We had to get releases from people. And on the back of that manila envelope, we would sit there and just kind of come up with premises. You know, like I'd look out the street and see a telephone pole, and I'd say, okay, you know, be a human telephone pole. Okay. So we'd write that down as an idea, you know. You know, would you be a human telephone pole? Maybe there'd be a travel poster of Venice, Italy, or something like that. And we, you know, have a premise of can we trade your brain for the brain of a person who lives in Venice, Italy?
Right.
You know, and they'd go, well, why Venice, Italy? And we were off. But we definitely had a whole list of these things every day. And some of them would work and some of them wouldn't, or some of them we'd fall into a situation where when it hadn't worked earlier, it was just perfect, you know. We'd walk into a drugstore or something like that and try about operating equipment. Because Jim was going to operate on me. So, you know, we were thoroughly prepared, and this really helped me out through the rest of my career. I mean, to sit down and prepare before you go out and not think of this thing as, we would ad lib sometimes, you know, or, you know, often. But, you know, being prepared and having a bunch of things, so you started out the day with something to grab onto before you went out on the street. And I've had to use that, you know, that same thing. I call it premisizing. The years doing radio commercials and, you know, just write down every idea I can think of, you know, for the product. That's how they sort of happened, you know. One, you know, they just got triggered off by something we're looking at or something that was in the paper.
Was there, for example, you take an idea like, I don't know, the first thing that comes to my mind, threeisms. And would you approach maybe, you know, it sounds amazing on the album, but were there like four different takes with four different people that just didn't cut it and you chose the best one or?
No, I think that's the only one we ever did of that one, that particular one. You know, there's a lot of that, there's a lot of that new age stuff, you know, was starting to develop here in San Francisco.
Right,
so,
of course.
So threeism was a new concept that we would get on the bus with this guy and there'd be three of us and
yes.
He would now be living in threeism and and you know, and the feeling of being on the bus, you know, with all these other people.
The best part of that bit is when Jim Coyle is trying to convince him, and the way his voice sounds, it sounds like it's a convincing voice, but what's coming out of his mouth is an even worse premise for the victim. You know, we want you to leave your life now. Of course, we want you to make that decision now. He's trying to convince him in the worst way possible. I thought that those are the moments that make me
crack.
Let us
come back with you right now to your rooming house, or you know, to your apartment, and we will start to live as three. You know.
Excuse me. Can we take a moment of your time?
Sure.
What we'd like to do is acquaint you with the concept of threeism. Are you familiar with this?
Pardon me?
Threeism.
Threeism? No, I'm not.
Three people get together and merge your identity as one. Would you ever consider giving up your identity as an individual to be a third of one person?
Is this a religious concept?
No. It's just a spiritual idea that we have conceived with some other people.
I'd have to know more about it.
We give you a demonstration of threeism?
Right now?
Yes.
Well, I'm kind of in a hurry. I have an appointment at 7 o'clock, and I haven't eaten yet.
Could we accompany you to your meal and show you how threeism will work? We will help you make the selection of your food.
There is nothing we will do that will not be a unit decision.
Wait a minute now. That's two against one for me eating at my place. The dinner's ready.
Dinner
at my place?
Yes. We could eat dinner at your home.
And can I ask you, what are we having for dinner?
I don't know yet.
And how will you introduce us to whoever else is in the house?
Well, how am I supposed to introduce us?
How would you introduce us?
Yeah, these are two-thirds of my personality.
Would you do it on a permanent basis?
Well, for the rest of my life?
Right, exactly. We're asking you to make that decision now.
You're asking me to make the decision right now?
Yes.
Well, I decline.
No. There are three of us right now. If we could stay together, it would be so much better.
Let us go away as one, now. No more personal decisions on your... on your own part.
Hey, what's wrong? Why are you walking away?
I'd change my mind. No,
you're walking away.
Why you walked away? What did you say we were?
I don't want to be a threeist.
You said we're out of our minds.
And you know, it's just because you don't understand a concept you've never been exposed to.
What are you doing? Getting an officer?
No, I'm looking for the bus.
Let's go on the bus together.
What are we trying to railroad you into? Tell us.
That's your concept, a better life.
You're turning down an opportunity for threeism?
You are in our destiny.
Who told you that?
You are the tertiary person, the triad.
It's an awareness of the meaning and the destiny of threeism.
Who thought up this threeism?
We did.
When did this begin?
Last week. We'll tell you honestly. It came to us and we accept it.
Mm-hmm. Here's my buzz.
All right, we're going with you.
May we go with you?
We haven't eaten. We haven't eaten in a long time.
Neither have I.
Now we're getting on the bus with the gentleman. Are you going to pay the fare, sir?
I got 15 cents.
Now we're walking down the aisle of the bus with the triad person. Could we stand together as a triad here in the bus?
I'm tired.
Now, isn't this the first example of threeism?
Right.
Suddenly, instead of yourself alone getting on the bus, there are three of us on the bus, right?
Isn't that true?
That's true.
And we're riding to your home?
Yeah.
What bus is this?
6 Masonic.
And is it so bad?
Well, there's a lot of people on the bus.
But there's three of us together on the bus.
This guy's as close to me as you are.
He didn't speak with us. We haven't chosen him as a threeist.
Oh, you've chosen me.
You have come into our destiny, and you shall remain as thus forth, henceforth from the 6 Masonic bus to your home, and forevermore you shall be with us. Is that not true? Answerest thou to thy triad companions, waiting for thy answer?
No.
Can we tell you something?
Yeah.
This is a joke.
In 2007, you guys started a podcast, and there was, like I've heard, there's like 100 hours of this stuff, and I guess this you're taking from this treasure trove of 100 hours and posting it online. There's ideas on there that just blew me away, like edges. That kind of stuff. That stuff,
Someone else mentioned that lately. I can't remember edges.
it's so absurd and surreal. I just don't think most, or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the audience nowadays is more sophisticated now and caught up that they would find that incredibly hilarious. But
well, one thing I've sort of noticed with the material, even though we did it like in 1963, 1964, and the people sort of have a dated way of speaking, you know, it's a kind of archaeology of voices, you know.
Yes.
There's a different attitude and everything like that. But there's also, I find in the sequences, a tremendous immediacy. You know, it really doesn't sound old to me, you know, at this point. Of course, it's my work. But there seems something engaging, you know, still in those premises.
Well, I think it's those ideas were just so cutting edge for then and for now. And that's something I wanted to ask you about. Well, not ask you, but just kind of mention it, if you have observed this yourself, the people you approached on the Coil and Sharp stuff in the early 60s, the public changes. Like after JFK, after the Vietnam War, you hear the change on your solo albums where the people are more guarded, more jaded, a little angrier. It's quite an interesting look. A juxtaposition of just American people, just everyday people.
I don't know if I agree with you. I wasn't with Jim then. And it was sort of a different kind of thing when I was on my own. But, it was still pretty much still relatively tame man on the street thing, you know. I think later when there were a lot of these kind of things on the street, different shows doing things with, you know, man on the street kind of interviews, other people doing them, so people got really hip, and they, as soon as you propose some kind of crazy thing, they say, where's the camera?
Right.
You know, when the media was so, you know, obvious.
Yeah.
And then they were also very paranoid, you know. I mean, if you said something to them that kind of threatened a little bit of insecurity in them, you know.
Yeah.
They'd get really nervous, you know, if I said something like, you know, we want to rob a bank and we want you to go inside and get the money. And you know, we'd be outside. This is just for a film, and we're going to quit filming all this, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you did something that, you know, that now, or first of all, people just think, you know, everybody's got a gun.
Yep.
And, you know, that's when it started to get harder to do. You know, people were just more skeptical. And you know, the media kind of caused that in a way. Because we were pretty unusual, you know, two guys standing out in the street in 1963 with a tape recorder.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people hadn't seen that, and they were a little in awe of it, too, back then. And they sort of respected the journalists from the radio station.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you commanded a lot more respect than how they're looked on today, yeah.
Yeah, today, you know, they're ready to, you know, moon you in 30 seconds to get on television, you know.
Yeah, right, right.
Am I going to be on? Yeah, what do you want, you know? And also, you know, because they know it's for television or radio, they try and turn on and be clever. And that's always a tough thing to deal with because you don't want them to be canned, you know. You want them to have fresh ideas. And so a lot of things became harder.
Wanting to be in the spotlight and be kind of a star for a few minutes.
Yeah.
You hearken on that.
Everybody's David Letterman now, you know, I mean.
Yeah. So you hearken on that on, like, there's that one bit I remember on the Coil and Sharp recordings where you're describing this job that you want this guy to work in, and it's a living hell with wolverines and maniacs, and he's all for it. And it's kind of, you know, it kind of led with what we have now, like people willing to do anything, Fear Factor, and people willing to do anything just so they can be on TV and maybe make a quick buck.
Yeah, yeah, or become a celebrity.
The
thing we did with Living Hell, you got to remember, too, we never really tried to push this, but we were often, I think we called it a job opportunity. I think that's what we call a job opportunity.
Right.
And you'd go down in this shed below San Francisco, and there'd be piranha fish and moats, you know, and you'd have to swim through, and we'd give you an armband that say you were a non-combatant, because the animals and the fish were fighting with each other, and there were hawks in the air, you know, it was just kind of fantastical.
This is Mal Sharp with another in the series Job Opportunities. Every day I bring an employer out onto the street and have him offer a San Franciscan an interesting and novel job. Now I have James P. Coyle with me, our employer of the day, and I've just stopped a young man who we're going to offer a job to.
I am James P. Coyle, and I'm very glad to meet you.
Same here.
The nature of the job is it's a little unusual. Just like anything else, there are certain risks entailed in it. You would be working down in a pit in which I have created, through scientific endeavor, I have created intense flame. People throw objects in the flaming pit. You go through. You pick them up. They name the object. You pick them up, and I charge them admission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'd be interested. It's something new and exciting, you know, and I like excitement.
The reason I ask, I had an employee before, and I will tell you this directly and honestly. He was a little careless and incautious. I gave him specific instructions, and he perished. Now, I want you to understand this before we get any further. He did perish.
I understand. Well, mistakes can happen sometimes.
Now, as I understand it, the death index on this job, they give us a death index, is about 98%. In other words, if you took this job, the chance of your actual perishing would be 98% in favor of your perishing.
It's a chance. I like to take chances.
What we're trying to do, really, is to create a living hell. Have people pay admission. They look down in the pit. They see you down there. The flames are all around you. There will be four maniacs with you, and you've got to control them.
Now, wait a minute. I understand that you said four maniacs?
Yes.
Yeah. And you mean I got to tell them what to do or try to keep them together or something like that?
Yes, exactly. Control them and see that they don't interfere with you, because they will. That's what they're going to try and do.
Uh-huh.
They're fully costumed. They're fully protected, and they're going to be attacking you, and this is part of the attraction.
Oh, I see. It sounds very interesting.
Have you worked with maniacs before?
No, never.
Have you worked with flame before?
No, not necessarily.
One other aspect, large bats fly through the air. You've seen bats, haven't you? These are very large bats with, I might say, extremely large teeth from the photo I saw. They'll be swooping down over your head. Would the bats at all deter you from doing your job?
No, I don't think so. If I had a job to do, I'd try to do it regardless of the bats or anybody else.
Now, I'll explain the situation to start with. I want to be sure you can handle a job. I am paying $46 a week initially. Is this agreeable?
Sounds okay.
And I am offering not only the $46, but during the 12 hours that you'll be down in the pit every day, I will provide nourishment to you. In other words, I will provide one meal during that 12-hour period. Will that be satisfactory?
Sounds okay.
Have you ever consumed bats?
No, I haven't.
Would you look forward to the idea of actually consuming bats?
Eating one?
Yes.
I guess so.
In other words, your lunch. You go down and open up your little brown paper bag that Mr. Coyle had prepared, and inside there would be a bat, and then you would just prepare it down in the flames.
Oh, I had to cook it myself?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Why?
Oh, no. If you could cook it for me, I wouldn't mind eating it, but, you know.
Cook what?
A bat.
Yeah.
But as long as I didn't see it cooking, you know, I think I could devour it.
Have you ever had any experience with snakes, large snakes?
No.
See, the bats actually, they're foes down in this pit. The reason why the bats are there is because there are snakes in the pit.
Uh-huh.
The bats attack the snakes, and the snakes will be curling around your feet as you're trying to handle the maniacs.
Yeah, I'm not scared of snakes, though.
What?
I'm not scared of snakes.
Are you at all, and be honest, are you at all afraid of the maniacs?
No, not really.
What are you going to do with them if they start attacking you?
Fight them off.
And this is what the people pay for.
Uh-huh.
The people who are looking down in the pit pay to see you surrounded by flames, picking up objects that they throw down to you. You'll be attacked by the maniacs and the bats. The snakes will be crawling at your feet. This, you understand, this is what the people pay for.
Yeah. Well, They pay to see it. Give them their money's worth.
Now, do you, what I'd like to know is that you fully understand the job. Can you, in your own way, recapitulate what I've told you about the job so that we know that you do have an understanding of it?
Yeah, it seems to me you want me to work in some kind of a pit. As you say, you're trying to develop a living hell. And in this pit, I wear some sort of a uniform, and it'll be a lot of flames. And I have to work with maniacs and watch out for bats flying around. And I'll get one meal a day. I'll be in there for 12 hours, and I'll have to eat a bat.
And you will take the position.
Yeah, I'd like to try it.
Now, with all these ideas, and you mentioned, you know, you can't get away with it. Now, was there any time that you and Jim Coyle did get in trouble, whether it's with, you know, the police or with, like, people you approached, or did they turn the prank around on you guys? Like, I'm sure there must have been a few incidents.
Yeah, well, when we signed up with Warner Brothers Records, we were quite excited about that. This is mm-hmm. our first record. And they told us that because we were joining Warner Brothers, we'd have to take a little medical exam, and the doctor Cohen would be here in a few minutes. And a few minutes, we were just sitting alone in this room. A few minutes later, Dr. Cohen came in, and he had a little, you know, doctor's bag, and he took out this glass, and he said, just go down to the restroom here and give me a sample. You know, he gave it to me. And I walked down the hall of the restroom, you know, and peed in this glass, you know. But then I was trying to bootleg it when I walked back, because all the secretaries were sitting along there. You know, you can't go walking down the thing with a, you know, glass of urine in your hand. Right. And I sort of bootlegged it back there, and then Coyle gave his specimen, and we would see. He says, you know, I'll analyze it, and I'll be right back. And 2 minutes later, they opened the door, and the whole staff of Warner Brothers Records was out there double over laughing. They all had known what was going on.
Oh, and wow.
It was kind of funny how we tried to, you know, hide the specimens and that sort of thing. So we did get taken in.
Right. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
So, yeah, it was a good one.
Oh, that's cool. That I mean, whoever thought that up, man.
Yeah, they said they spent hours working on it, you know, trying to figure something, get us, you know, and they got us big time. I mean, we were so excited to be there, you know. Well, we're Warner Brothers. We have health insurance.
Right.
Can we have your name, please?
Stan Winsek of Santa Barbara.
Of Santa Barbara, California,
yes,
Stan.
Sir.
Do you listen to radio jingles at any time?
Yes, I do.
We at KGO have devised a new radio jingle. Actually, we've devised a series of several new ones. We're going to give you one today, get your reaction to it. If you like it, maybe we'll go ahead with it.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Okay. Okay, fine. Here's the first KGO jingle.
K-G-O. K-G-O.
Oh. K-G-O.
K-G-O.
K-G-O. Radio in San Francisco.
K-G-O.
Co.
No.
Why?
What?
Be honest.
The jingle was too long, and it didn't send a message quick enough.
It didn't?
What message? Did you get the message that...
I think it's
a lovely city.
Yes. Oh, there's no doubt that it is a lovely city.
Right,
it didn't really send me, and I appreciate good jingles. I like them very much.
Can we try another one for you?
Yes, if you please.
Radio.
How did you feel about that one?
I like that a little bit better.
Why?
When people think of San Francisco, they think of atmosphere and the warm character of the town, and that was more towards it. Yes, it was.
What did that express to you?
Chinatown is highly dramatized, and the whole character city. I've been here.
The romance of San Francisco, perhaps.
That's a very good choice of adjective.
Now, can we give you a final jingle and get your reaction to it?
Fine.
Could you do this? Could you just hum while we sing our final KGO station break?
Okay.
All right. You start humming, then we'll start singing. Are you ready?
Okay.
One, two, three. You hum, and we'll...
KGO, San Francisco.
You mentioned that you had, like, whenever you'd approach someone, you'd have, like, a release form for them to sign. And so is that why, like, there's, like, full disclosure at the beginning of each bit with their name, like, their full first and last name? I always thought that was, like, with today, that's quite odd. Like, no one would usually give up both names, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was just a way of loosening people up, you know, getting size them up a little bit. Yeah, we usually ask them their name just to get a feeling and get the conversation rolling,
right.
Size them up, size up what their voice sounded like, and see how they felt in relation to us, whether this was going to be somebody that was easy to talk to. And it was always more personal, too, when they, you know, they'd say their name, I'm Milton Edwards, you know, and Quill could say, well, Milt, the Japanese scientists have come up with a way of installing a transistor radio in your head, you know.
Right.
And it was just kind of friendly, you know. And,
yeah.
And later in the sequence would say, you promised at the beginning, Milton, that you were going to do this. you have volunteered to have the radio put in your head, you know.
There's a lot of gags about brain surgery.
Yeah.
That's one of your trademarks, I imagine.
Well, we had a piggyback brain. We had a piggy bank. You know, you could put like a half a dollar in your head and it would multiply. You know, it would multiply until your head got too heavy, and then we'd come and empty it out.
And then cut the person a percentage only. That was the best part.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. We'll give you a percentage. Give you 3%.
I was always wondering, where did you get those boys to help you with your bits when it came time to do bits on children, which would always shock people? I mean,
they were the sons of some folks who owned a record store. Coyle collected classical music, and he met these kids. And so we brought them out, and, you know, it was always fun to work with kids because people were living, and these kids were kind of glib.
Yeah,
so when we told someone on the street that these kids want to come and become your children for a week, you know, they want to come to your house, and because we're thinking of starting a rental agency with children, and children could be rented out. I mean, it's almost a little too much right now. It's not even funny, I guess. You know, but then there was not all this stuff in the air, you know, what's going on now.
But I always thought those two kids really played it well. Like they had, like, it sounded like they kept their poker faces pretty intact.
Yeah, they were really good. We want to come and live in your house, and we want to go home with you. You know, we love our parents. That's not the thing, you know, but it would be really interesting to have a different life for a week. Please, you know, take us with you right now. And the guy goes, well, I got to go back to work. Well, we should just sit in the lobby, you know. They had good answers for stuff.
Yeah, it was, and I always noticed, like, a lot of the people who you asked didn't sound like they were from California. They were not even American, a lot of them. Like, I was, or maybe you just chose those bits, I mean, to make it sound.
No, we I don't know if you know San Francisco, but we worked a lot on Market Street, and that ran down to the waterfront, and a lot of ships would come in, you know, and with tourists, you know, from England.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So we would spot them. We got good at spotting. Then there was a difference in clothes. Now it's all international style. But, you know, we could spot an Englishman with his boxy shoes and his tweedy suit. And we just loved to talk with foreigners because their vocabulary was so different. And especially the English people, and they could sound so, you know, you want me to go down into that pit, you know, and swim at the piranhas? Really? You expect, you know, a human being to do that sort of effort, you know? And so, yeah, we stopped a lot of when we could. We love to stop tourists.
One of the best bits that matched the person, the victim, or the subject's voice with the idea that you guys were trying to put across was the blotch, because the guy already had this kind of this haughty kind of sounding voice, and it just, the idea just made it all the more absurd. It was amazing.
can't believe anybody is proposing a situation like this. And then, of course, we would always say, a situation like what? We'd love to get them to describe it. You know, we're putting a blotch on a person, and that would signify they were part of some movement. And you want me to put a blotch on? I mean, it's absolutely absurd. But what's absurd about it? Well, who wants to walk around with a blotch on their head, you know?
You're wanting me to pick out of the crowd of the people coming along this street someone who I think is ideally suited to fit into your community, and then put a mark on his forehead.
A blotch?
A blotch, yes. Because you want to find out who I think are the ideally suited people to go along into your community.
And then what are we going to do?
You're going to look for the blotches.
And then we're going to found the community.
Yeah.
Take the people with the blotches and start the new community.
You can't just pick people out of a crowd and say you're going to start a new community.
And why not?
Why? Because some people, I believe that you must have the freedom and right to choose whether you're going to live in the place or not.
What is unfair about seeing somebody that you think is happy?
Now, what should I think? Why should I be the one who thinks it?
Somebody has to do it.
I dare say someone has got to do it, but why should it be just the one person who is not even living in the country?
That's the idea. You're not biased.
I am biased.
In what way?
Well, I don't know. I know very little about America, but what we hear in Great Britain doesn't give us a very good impression sometimes.
Who founded America?
Great Britain, yeah.
And you would be a new founder.
Inside that time, the people have changed.
And we respect you, and we'd like to rely on your judgment.
What I've been trying to explain to you is that I haven't the time. If I had the
time to what?
Walk along the street and mark people's foreheads with a blotch.
Right.
But I haven't got the time. This is what I've been trying to explain to you. If I had the time, if I was here for more than an hour, I would.
How many people could you mark in an hour? How many people could you blotch? At least 10 people, right? Or 15 people? This would be the nucleus for the new community.
Yes, I have no wish to find a new community on the lines that you're trying to explain, I'm afraid.
Is that the spirit that your ancestors showed at Jamestown and showed at Plymouth Rock? You're taking a stand against happiness now, aren't you?
Now, look, you're putting words into my mouth.
But isn't that true? Aren't you taking a stand against happiness?
No, I am not.
No.
I'm afraid I've wasted enough time.
Why are you running away? Why are you racing away from me?
Because I haven't got the time. I'm just in this city for an hour or two. I want to see as much of this city.
Please
I don't
blotch,
want to...
blotch some people for us.
No, I won't.
For half an hour.
No, I won't.
There's a bit off of the second Corlin Sharp album, which is the Insane But Hilarious Mind,
right.
About the folk singing hoax.
Right.
What was that live show? It sounds like you guys were performing live. Like, this isn't Man on the Street. Like, what was that?
Okay. Yeah, some guy that was working with us from Warner Brothers said, why don't you go down to the Bear's Lair? It's a coffee shop and kind of beer place at the University of California right down the street, and just do something on stage. Well, that was 63 and 64 was kind of the height of the folk singing craze, you know, Joan Baez and,
right.
you know, people like that.
Yeah.
And I hated folk singing. I'm sorry. I was into Louis Armstrong.
Right.
I hated folk singing, and so we decided to get this guy to introduce us as Nóg and Palak, two Icelandic folk singers that are going to be recorded for Warner Brothers Records, and they're here in San Francisco or Berkeley right now, and they're going to perform for you tonight, you know. And we had these weird suits, you know, just business suits. Sort of thing, but we made ourselves look kind of awkward, and we spoke with accents. You know, we are Nóg and Palak, and we come here. We sing the song of the harvest, and now this was in front of an audience. You know, at the Bear's Lair. You know, 300 people that probably love folk singing, and then we just started singing in Bugravian, and that was the language we were from. That's it. We were from Bugravia.
Bugravia, yes.
Yeah. And an island that became very prominent in a lot of our sequences. We are Bugravians. And then we just started singing. We had no idea what we were going to sing about. You know, ya kole makate, yo kole makama, yo. And we'd do some little dance on the stage. And people's eyes were just bugging out. They hadn't seen anything like this. And they just cheered wildly, you know, for each song we did. We did about three or four songs. And then our friend came back up and he says, I got to tell you, you know, they're really not Nose and Paylock. They're Jim Coyle and Mal Sharpe. And they're doing a new Warner Brothers record. And they do, you know. And there's this big groan from the audience. Oh, you know. But it was a very enjoyable thing for us to do, especially me, because I love sort of, I know this is a little sick, but I love sticking into the folk singers. I just didn't like that style of music, you know, the endless verses to Irish sea chanties and things like that.
Well, I mean, you make it very clear the kind of music that you like, even on your solo albums, especially the inclusion of Neil Sean from Journey. I love that bit. That's the best.
Yeah. Well, I worked for this radio station here in San Francisco, KMEL, for a year after the Meaning of Life album came out.
Right.
And so I got to go to all the rock and roll things. I was the oldest one in the station. I think I was 44 then. Mm-hmm. And they found it quite amusing. We'd be like riding out to some big concert at the ballpark. And the radio would be on, and they'd say, who's that on the radio right now, Mal? I said, geez, I don't know. I don't know one group from another. They went, it's the Rolling Stones. You know? And no, but anyway.
Oh, that's great.
So a lot of those things, you know, like you just mentioned there, that were done while working for KMEL. The Camel.
I know you don't like folk singing. I know you don't like rock. What was your reaction when Henry Rollins reached out to you to release that on the Loose CD? Did you go back and listen to Black Flag or the Rollins Band or any of his bands?
No, I thought when this girl called me up and said, you know, Henry Rollins wants to talk to you, I immediately thought it was Rollins from Rollins and Joffe, the producers of a lot of the Woody Allen movies.
Oh,
that's Henry Rollins. I didn't know Henry Rollins. I didn't know. And you know, the girl at the office said, "I can't believe this. You don't know who Henry Rollins is." I said, "No." So she sent me something. Henry is a great guy, and he really encouraged us. And he, like you, he knew a lot of the sequences verbatim, and. And you know, could repeat lines back to us that even I couldn't remember. And another one of our big fans was Andy Kaufman. Do you know who Andy Kaufman is?
Oh, of course. And that makes sense.
Yeah, Andy. And I liked Andy's stuff, too. You know, the idea of he would go on stage. We'd see him in Los Angeles when we lived there. And he would go and he would just start reading some John Steinbeck novel. And he would go on for like an hour and people started screaming at him, stop it, all right, enough for him. Henry just kept, and you know, so it was really charming, you know. There were all these oddballs out there that liked us. We weren't a big record seller or anything like that. But.
Have you ever heard of I'm from Toronto, I'm calling you from Toronto. Have you ever heard of a Canadian named Nardwar, the human serviette?
The human serviette?
Yes, he's a personality. He's a radio personality. He became a kind of a TV personality. He's in a band. He sings in a band, et cetera, et cetera. But he, I swear to God, he took from you an ode to you, where he was able to get into a Mikhail Gorbachev news conference, and he asked him, out of all the world leaders you have met, who has the biggest pants? And I swear, that's just like, what's your favorite fish?
Yeah, right.
I always wondered if you'd heard that.
No. What's your favorite fish? Which I asked at the Democratic Convention when Geraldine Ferraro was nominated for vice president, I guess. And the crowd went wild, especially the women. And I just started walking around. Are you excited about this? I'm thrilled about it. Really? Why? It's a women's moment and everything like that. What's your favorite fish? What? You know, well, somebody told me that somebody did that bit outside of Parliament in England. You know, I'd occasionally get these things. But,
right.
You know.
Well, me being familiar with your albums, when I heard that bit, I was like, wait, why is this familiar? Why have I heard? The Biggest Chance is great, and he got, you know, he got a little bit of notoriety and a little bit of a write-up in the news, but nobody referenced you. And I always thought, if I ever see him again, I'll ask him about that bit. But it
what's
definitely
his name, what's
was
his name again?
Nardwar the Human Serviette. That actual moment is on YouTube, and I can email you that moment.
Okay.
I'll email you the clip.
Okay.
But thank you so much for this. Okay.
Okay, Danko. Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Mal. This has been a pleasure, an honor, a thrill, and it's made my week.
All right. Well, anytime. Good luck on your podcast.
Thanks a lot, Mal.
Okay. Ciao.
Bye-bye.
Excuse us, we have a what we call word trade. We stop people in the street. We exchange a word for something that they are carrying. What is this you have in your hand?
It's a cake. My cohorts at work are going to consume it.
Can we trade a word for your cake?
Well, I should say not.
It's an attempt to introduce something that is non-solid into the world of solids, into the world of matter. A word is essentially non-material, right?
Yes.
The cake has substance and therefore
yes.
is matter.
That doesn't sound right to me at all.
In what way?
Well, a cake is something you can see it and it's there, and words are just vibrations. I mean, you can always...
Words can change a man's life, can't they?
Yes, I would say so.
And can the cake really change a man's life? Which has had more influence in the history of mankind, words or cake?
Well, I say it all depends where the words are placed.
Are you opposed to literature?
No, I think it's great.
What do you place more emphasis on? Be honest. What do you have more respect for, the ability to communicate or cake?
See, the cake isn't all mine, see, and I don't have the right to exchange it for the words, see, otherwise I might, I don't know.
What are we asking you to do?
In essence, you're saying that words are more valuable than cake, and you're saying that you're going to give me the words in exchange for the cake, and...
Even if we were going to give you, a pronoun?
The type of the word would have no value as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. You would have full use of whatever etymological units we gave you. You realize you would have full use for the remainder of the day. This wouldn't be a restricted usage.
I think I'd have use of it whether you gave it to me or not. See, a word you can't.
No, not because we hadn't made the exchange. Let us give you an entire clause.
Is this clause is going to be of any significance? I mean, is it going
to
tell
me something
that I don't know? Or?
It's up to you how you use it.
You say that I'm going to use this clause if you were to give it to me. Is that it?
Yes,
I mean,
and you might use it to your own value.
You think it might be some value to me?
Probably more value than the cake. We're doing it not to get the cake, or we're doing it to interest people in the value of words.
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm.
I originally had the word his in mind, which was a pronoun mm-hmm. you were going to have use of for the entire day. Or we might have given you the word there, mm-hmm. the possessive word there.
Yeah, well, I've already used the word his and there, and I don't think in that respect you would be actually giving me anything.
Then you already owe us the cake.
Well, I say it's not my cake. If you want to come down to the office,
could we really? Can we join you now?